With us on the line now from the UK is Annabelle Croft. She's a former British number one tennis player. After retiring from tennis at the age of only 21, she became a TV presenter, hosting shows like Treasure Hunt and Interceptor. She's been involved in Wimbledon coverage for various channels over the years, but this year's tournament is, of course, cancelled for the first time since World War II. Welcome to the show, Annabelle.
Oh, thank you very much.
Pleasure. It's lovely to have you with us. And very, very sad news, of course, about Wimbledon not being on this year. Very annoying for tennis fans.
Yeah, it's disappointing, obviously. The announcement was made quite early, actually. I think we all wondered whether it was going to come. And when you consider it's such a huge global sporting event, and it's the pinnacle of tennis, really. We have four Grand Slams during the year, but I think a lot of people feel that Wimbledon probably is the greatest tournament, in the world. So, of course, it's disappointing, but I think it also, along with every other sport, all the athletes feel the same way, that it puts sport into context a little bit and makes you realise that there are bigger, more important things going on in the world sometimes. I think sometimes when you're in sport, you think you're in a bubble. But equally, it makes us realise how much we love it and how much we'll look forward to it when it comes back next year.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you enjoy the commentating side of things, having played the sport yourself?
I do. I really love it because, I see things that I probably didn't do when I was playing, but also you recognize body language, you recognize expressions, you recognize emotions, and obviously technically you're picking up things. But I think it's an awful lot easier to be sitting there and talking about it than out there playing it. It's a hugely pressurized sport. It's very psychological. You're on the line, you're on your own, there's nowhere to hide. I mean, I had a wonderful time playing. I enjoyed my time on the tour. I travelled the world. I met amazing people. I came to Marbella actually to train many times. But, I just feel at the end of the day, I had done what I wanted to do in the sport. And I moved on to other things and then came back to it sort of through the commentary side of it.
So,
tennis has been my whole life.
Because retiring at 21, that's such a young age, isn't it? It sounds funny to think of retiring from anything at the age of 21. Why did you stop then?
Well, many reasons, really. I mean, weirdly, my youngest child now is 22 and I've got three. And so it's very odd when I look at my youngest daughter and I sort of think, wow, I'd already had a lifetime traveling around the globe since I was about 12. And she's just, looking ahead to her career. But I realise that to many people it sounds very young, but when you've done the sport since you were a little kid and travelled internationally from 12, I'd done nothing else but pick up a racket and play tennis and done about 6 or 7 years on the main tour, because I was on the tour when I was 15. By the time I was 21, I was a little bit burnt out sort of psychologically and mentally, and I just needed to go and do other things in life. And I definitely think it was the right decision, but obviously in hindsight, when I'm about to be 54, as a much older person now, looking back, I realise there are many things that I'd like to have approached my tennis in a different way. But of course, you can only do that with hindsight and a different mind and a different perspective on life.
Yeah. And with a sport like tennis, how do you know when you've reached a certain level, from just being a good tennis player, someone who enjoys tennis and plays regularly, to then know that you can really start going into the big competitions?
Well, that's a really good question because, I first picked up a racket in my Marbella. It was at the Los Monteros Hotel, actually. And, there was some group coaching going on at the hotel. I mean, many listeners may remember the late Lou Hose used to sort of run the tennis there as well.
Yeah.
So that was where I found my tennis and I absolutely loved it. And I came back home and I really had found something that I loved so much. I was doing ballet at the time and riding, but once I found tennis, it kind of took over my life. And then I started to play tournaments and I won the nationals unexpectedly at the age of 12 as a complete sort of rank outsider, really. And then from that moment on, I got invited to go and do national training at Bisham Abbey here in the UK. And I kind of didn't really stop and think about what I was doing. I never had a choice in it. It was just kind of all being sent in one direction. And of course, then you're being invited to play to represent your country. And I was going off to Sweden and France and Germany and Holland and playing all these international matches for Great Britain. And, you know, I didn't really have time to stop and think about, was this actually what I wanted to do? I was loving it so much. But then the reality of the lifestyle on the tour, which is like a travelling circus, it looks very glamorous from the outside, but it was incredibly lonely, actually, and very soul-destroying sometimes. And that happiness depended on winning tennis matches. And I just reached a point where I thought, you know what, I really feel like I want to do other things in my life and kind of get some perspective on it. But yeah. As I said, you know, I don't want to get the old violin out and start playing the sad music, because, you know, I had some many wonderful times as well. And as I said, you kind of look back with a different perspective when you're older.
It must be a massive amount of pressure, though, that both you're putting on yourself and all the people around you are putting on you as well.
You know, yeah, it was. I mean, I was British number one, and you have sponsors, and, you know, sponsors are quite often asking, what's your ranking? And, you know, I think, you know, I had lawyers and managers and coaches and parents, and, you know, there's an awful lot of people that are interested and, you know, excited about your tennis or your sport. And so, you know, they can't help it, but that is a pressure in itself, that you're trying to please lots of people. But ultimately, you are trying to please yourself as well. It's a very selfish sport. So, you know, I think pressure is tough, isn't it? But then there's pressure in all walks of life. There's pressure in everything you do. But I also think that sport does teach you about having humility, learning how to lose, how to accept defeat and try to pick yourself up. It's almost more impressive when you can pick yourself up from defeats, actually. That's where the biggest learning curve comes. And I think that's why sport's so important for kids to play, actually, because you can't always be a winner in everything. And you have to learn how to accept those defeats and learn from it and move on.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of lessons to learn from sport.
And when you're playing it at a young age, it must kind of take over your social life in a way. I mean, were you training like every day?
Yes. I mean, I look back, and again, you know, with having brought up three kids, and I see what normal lives they've had growing up as children and going to kids' parties, and then all those teenage years where, you know, they're out late and, you know, you might start trying to drink a glass of wine or beer or whatever. And, you know, I look back and I realise that I didn't really have any of that. I mean, I went to live in America when I was 15. There were a million parties that I missed because I was always having to train the next day. I never regretted it because I always thought, oh, I was doing something different. And, you know, I really wanted to you know, throw myself into the tennis and the training. Or I might have had matches and tournaments. But, you know, I do realize that I did not have a normal childhood in terms of that, you know, what normal kids will be doing out there in parties and socializing. So, you know, I didn't have a normal school life either. You know, I was always leaving school at lunchtime, getting on a train to go up to London, and then training every afternoon up in town. And, you know, I missed an enormous amount of schoolwork, and I've learned a lot through my kids. I mean, it's weird when they used to bring their homework back. It's like, oh my goodness, there's massive chunks of my education that are missing, and I was kind of learning through them, to be honest. And you learn through travel, don't you? You learn just being out there in the world. So, you know, but I think if you spoke to any athlete or anybody in any dedicated sport, most of them probably will have missed an enormous amount of like normal social activity in life. And I've definitely made up for it now, though.
Oh, that's good. There's a show that you did in 2009, which was really, really fascinating, that I just want to ask you briefly about, when you spent a few nights on the street. James, My Alcoholic Friend was the show.
Oh, yes.
What was that like?
Oh, you know what? That's, when I look back on a lot of the different things I've done in my TV career, I would say that living on the streets with the homeless for 10 days was the most extraordinary and the most, but not, I wouldn't want to use the word not uplifting. It just taught me so much about what is going on out there and what happens to these people, and about homelessness and the whole subject of homelessness. It was extraordinary, and I thought the producers did a great job of highlighting that. And that's the whole point of that program, was to bring it to people and to highlight it and to make people understand about it. And before I did the show, you know, many of us, you'll walk past homeless people in a tube station or something, and you'll give them a big wide berth, and you'll think, oh, why don't you just get up off your backside and go and get a job like the rest of us, and, you know, earn some money like the rest of us instead of begging for money. And I had no concept that a lot of them may have come from, you know, orphanages where there was some pretty awful stuff going on there that they just had to run away, and to go on the streets was better than being, you know, what was happening back in some of the homes. Some of them might have been soldiers that have just really, really struggled with coming to terms with what they might have seen out on the battlefields. You know, might have been just somebody's marriage has broken down and they've ended up with no house and maybe they lost their jobs. There were all sort of many, many different stories that I heard. But equally, I didn't realise that a lot of them don't even have an identity. And of course, if you live normally with a credit card or a passport, you can prove who you are. But if you live on the street, some of them just don't have any way of proving who they are to the authorities. And so it becomes this long process of trying to prove, you know, I'm Annabelle. Of course I'm Annabelle, but you can't prove it. So it was quite an extraordinary experience. And actually, I will tell you the story. James, who you've mentioned in that title, that was a follow-up program, actually, because we tracked down a guy that I had met on the streets and I'd slept in a cardboard box with him. He just happened to stumble across, you know, where we were, happened to be that day. And I kept in touch with him all this time. So if you say it's 2009, since then, and he's now completely off the streets. He has now retrained himself as a NHS nurse, and he's been working on the front line during this whole pandemic. He sends me photographs all the time. You know, he's come to Wimbledon. He's a really special person in my life, actually. I find him incredibly inspiring for what he's done in his life, because literally this man was at the bottom of the bottom of the pit that you could imagine. I mean, when I met him, he was like a tramp. He had long, disheveled hair, sores all over his head, sores all over his hand. He could hardly string a sentence together. You know, he was in a really, really bad place. And, you know, somehow over a period of time, you know, he's managed to turn his whole life around. And to see him in his nurse's uniform and doing what he's doing now, and he's married, and actually, he's half Spanish, actually. He has, half Scottish, half Spanish. But anyway, as I said, I've kept in touch with him, and he's a massive inspiration to me.
Oh, what a wonderful story. That's really fabulous to hear. And one of the things I remember watching that and various other documentaries and things about homelessness is, as you said, about the identity, if they haven't got the passport and things, and even haven't got an address.
They won't have an address.
It's not as simple as just going out and getting a job. You need an address to get a job. It's really complicated, isn't it?
It is very complicated. And what I did find when I was amongst so many of them is that they're unbelievably generous. They have nothing. They might have 50p in their pocket, and that is the sum total of what they own in life. And if I said, oh, I'm really thirsty, because you get very thirsty when you're living homeless, because you can't just walk into an establishment and just ask for a glass of water, because you'll get shooed out. And of course, it's very difficult to stay clean, and you know, you don't change clothes. It was freezing cold when they filmed the program, because it was sort of like -5 in December. But you know, if you said you were cold and you were hungry, they would always offer their money to you. And I found that extraordinary. You know, they, as I said, they had the least, but they would give the most, and they gravitate towards each other. And in many ways, it kind of helps to keep some of them down, because it's like us living in a normal way, socializing and having a normal life within a house or an environment. They are doing the same with each other, but at a very sub level. And, you know, they kind of stick together and they help each other, and they keep each other buoyant, because they're very, you know, they want to be social. So they're no different. And actually, I think that's what I also found was, you know, before I would have thought, oh, it's a bit scary, you know, going near people like that. And actually, when you talk to them, they are normal people who have a background story to tell. And, you know, I always say to people, you know, go and talk to homeless people, because nobody talks to them, really. They get given a wide berth and people treat them like they have some sort of lurgy or something. But actually, they have a really interesting story, and they would appreciate more than anything, actually, being talked to and spoken to and treated like a human being with respect. And when I hear politicians saying, you know, we must sort the housing crisis out and put roofs over these people's heads, that definitely is not the answer to the problem. It's a much deeper level than just a roof over their head. That would not solve the problem, I don't believe, because they need help in many other ways than just a roof. That definitely, I don't believe, would solve it.
No, it's a big issue, isn't it? Well, it's been a real pleasure to chat with you this morning, Annabel Croft.
Thank you so much for having me.
thank you for joining us, and hope to catch up again soon.
Yes, I hope to catch up soon. Bye.
Thanks, Annabel. Bye-bye.
Bye.